on it. So I've just learned how to use the timer on my thing so I don't run over. I hope you won't run over. Ah, I've lost it. Oh, I'll just cough, yeah. So much more planning. Yeah, I won't rabble on too much about the show, but I think I should tell you just something about it.
Sorry.
Simon said it's 6 monologues, and the idea was, because I was a bit cheesed off, really, with the way poetry was being viewed over, or at least at what I was seeing. I was getting the option to go to a poetry reading where everyone was taking themselves very, very seriously, and they've got their books, and it's all very, very stiff. Or the poetry seemed to be being taken over by hip-hop and rap and stuff. Or poets were kind of having to turn into comedians, and they didn't seem to be what the hell happened to poetry. So it's this, when I actually wrote it, I mean, I've been performing poetry for a while, some a long time, but when I wrote it, it was an attempt to kind of put, as Simon said, some poems from the first 3 collections, weave it seamlessly into some narrative to create a character that hopefully doesn't make the poetry stand out, but it's in there. And tonight I'll do 3 of the ladies for you. As I say, there are 6, and they're all a bit fucked up. Yeah, I'm just trying to get it so as I've told you as much as I can about the show. I won't rabble on now because I'm wasting my time. Right. Okay. Yeah. Oh, and also, yeah, there's some singing on the CD of trying to thingy bobby thing. Put some of the poems to music. So, right. Val. I'll just tell you a little bit about Val. She's in her mid-30s, so give me a bit of grace on that one. Yeah. She's in her mid-30s, she's got 4 kids. She's with an abusive partner who's a big drinker. She falls pregnant accidentally, and because her bloke just helps himself to her. And yeah, the baby ends up dying, and she's got the picture. And actually, in the full show, she does get her revenge. I'm going to cut it and leave you hanging tonight. This is Val. He was a clever man. He could craft argument like fresh scissors. He was precise. He was cautious. He was cautious as the letter V. He could dovetail each and every syllable until it fit. Exactly. He kept me in the curfew of skirting boards. But I listened to the livid sun screaming through windows. After the first year or two, the view just became something as if touched through gloves. The garden was a massacre of tulips, tight-lipped carnations, but the vase waited on the top shelf, obedient as dust, while I sat, learning to count clouds, how to mend the hem, how to fold everything into a perfect half. At first, I was stupid. I let him buy my time with roadside roses and guilt trips. He was just looking for himself and the broken promises he left for me to pluck. And he didn't notice. He didn't notice when I stopped wearing weekday lipstick, when the stitches dissolved. Dissolved like the sugar lumps I watched drown in a teaspoon in the caf. Where sometimes I just go to sit among trivial strangers who I actually trust more than myself. There I press tenderness against table legs, just to aggravate the new bruises that turned indigo overnight, while I lay awake, blooding cotton like a virgin, keeping his little secret under the bed. He didn't notice. He didn't notice when I stopped flinching whenever he spilt me on the kitchen floor, where I would lie curled toward the sun, watching another warm leak from my temple drip and crawl toward the door like a fat worm. A every time he'd go upstairs to get the blood on his shirt, leaving me to count the 98 stripes in the curtain again. The hem always needed mending. I said I'd get some red cotton, but tomorrow never came. Then I'd hear that cough. Phlegm spit in the toilet, flush. Knew he'd be back in 27 steps to smoke a Marlboro to the filter, then fuck off anywhere. When he'd leave, I'd drink tea with dirty breakfast things, get dressed, mop up the mess before the kids got in from school. He was a clever man. He could calculate my ovulation like a mathematician. So he really must have been very drunk that month. Fell pregnant. Didn't tell him at first, but then I did. So I remembered. He doesn't hit me when I'm carrying his kid. When I'm pregnant, but he just saved it all up for when the baby was born. Premature. She spent 3 weeks in intensive care. He broke my arm while she was in there. I couldn't hold her at first. Told the pretty nurse that I'd fallen down the stairs, but her eyes, they'd seen it all before. They let me take her home on the 4th of August. Such a pretty baby. I fed her, bathed her, laid her down to sleep. And the rest, well, that's between me and God. Because I know what I saw. I know what I heard. I heard the baby, its muffled screams. I could smell cigarettes. The pillow over my head. The other kids screaming, then the ambulance men banging the door in, and the baby was dead. And I said nothing. I said nothing, even when the just qualified doctor, he blamed the baby. He said it must have been respiratory difficulty, and I said nothing. Down the ice-white corridor, I knew they were blessing my tepid daughter in a cooling incubator, and all I could think, well, at least she's safe now. At least she's safe from Daddy's temper. Mummy unplugged her when they told me there was nothing more they could do. Doctor told her to. And that moment will beat Mummy's conscience like a dog. She knew that downstairs, under the casualty fire exit, there would be Daddy sucking another cigarette to death, nursing a guilty fist that will always forgive itself. Mummy, she said nothing, just watching her daughter turn blue. I left that day, I didn't even pack a bag. The other kids went to live with Mum and Dad. Now I'm in a place of safety. Till I'm ready to give the statement. They've managed to stabilise my medication. I spend most days watching children. In the park I found a few months ago in a bus window. I sit on the crack. Plastic swing and just swing, half not. And watch as evening signs a senile will in lard coloured cloud that gang up like cancer overhead. The threat of rain is always exhausting. All the other things I should be doing throw tantrums at my mind, and God, I want to still smoke. I rarely notice when tea time empties the climbing frame, and I collect the lost mittens in the grass. I like the hopscotch scuff tarmac behind till tomorrow after school, but I just sit, half swing, half not. and listen to sounds knit like skin healing. I am a woman alone in a dim playground. I have become fruit for wings. As I say, she does get her revenge. Right, so I'm going to tell you some of the characteristics of the next character. This girl is called Trudy. Now she's, let's put her in her 20s, so be kind again. She is a daddy's girl. She's a debutante. She gets absolutely everything she wants in every single way she wants. Daddy made sure she got a first class honours degree. Daddy makes sure, everything she wants. She's bisexual, she's trisexual, she's a completely insatiable hedonist. I really like this one. But then she takes after her dad, because he's much the same. She's a first class Oxford graduate. Where are we? Oh, he fakes up an interview for her, so it's with Versace, so she can go off to Barcelona. As I say, she's bisexual, she's dirty bitch, basically. And this tells of some of her sexual exploits. It's just all about sexy business, really. Okay. Right, she's a daddy's girl, and I do it in quite a posh English accent. What the fuck did he expect? I'm a red blood Oxford graduate. First class honours in Spanish politics, for fuck's sake. Thanks to Daddy. Daddy had negotiated some kind of summer job, an unconditional sum for me in Barcelona. But, of course, I had to be seen to jump the fucking hoop. So Daddy ripped a little interview. You could suggest that the office was some attempt at serious. Mahogany bookcase, leather-bound classics, a gabardine man with olive eyes. I wore grey snakeskin slingbacks to exaggerate my negligible ankles. Ivory silk-fitted blouse, pearl button at the neck. Sat. Wait. Teasing the nipple of my suspender belt through rouge cashmere. Well, I never do wear knickers to interviews. And the receptionist, how exciting. The receptionist, she was anorexic. She had a hint of hip, rhubarb cheek, a blonde ghost digging itself out of her slim throat. And yes, Daddy knows his daughter best. I just wanted to eat the fucking receptionist. So I took her for cocktails on Daddy's tab. She sat still as an exam. Blue bottle painted nails and quiet hair. She said her name was Susan. Well, I believed her. When she asked for mine, I didn't answer. I wanted to see if silence scared her. She sat still enough to touch. I suppose then she was convenient. Somewhere to park questions, feel uneasy with, nearly laugh. I suppose then she was enough of me to like some of someone else, and, well, something I didn't really need to know. Susan became my fascination. She was a dirty bitch. She liked me when I was ripe. For water. She said smells seduced her like threat. She liked it when I was ripe. She liked undressing my sour armpits, loved the blunt funk on my gusset. the expensive perfume behind my wrist, and that chewy stink when she pulled the tongue of my Gucci boot back to feed her nose like a selfish baby. Yes, she said smell seduced her like threat. She said she could feel it on my skin, in my hair, under my breath. And she loved to watch my calf muscles stretch out of bubbles and I shaped my legs. And if and when I felt like it, sometimes I'd just have a pip. And we'd giggle as we counted how very slowly it takes to watch yellow grow into water, into water. Needless to say, I didn't get the job, thank God. But Daddy said I should still go to Barcelona. You know, become more culturally aware. Funny, he seems to want me out of his hair since he's been fucking the au pair. But darling, who can blame him? She is gorgeous. Polish. Doesn't speak a word of English. Perfect. She has legs to her neck, tits and arse to die for. And who can blame him? I mean, Mummy. Mummy, she's gone to the dogs. She's way beyond Botox, and the last facelift didn't shift the crow's feet. Can't imagine she's much of a fuck. I have to feel quite sorry for her. Poor love. She's about as much fun as fucking cancer. So I said I'd go to Barcelona if Daddy paid for Susie to come too. Wasn't sure he'd approve of her tattoos, her nipple and clitoral piercing. But of course Daddy knows his daughter best, and of course Daddy said yes. And Barcelona, it was a party, darling. Yes, of course I fell in love once, or twice, or thrice. But there was one in particular. His name was Peter, an actor. And believe me when I tell you, he really was the reason for cravats, cufflinks, pinky rings. He wore green Italian leather shoes and was absolutely everything vodka promised to the right mood. He was classically handsome and blurred afternoon rehearsals with a Portuguese wine that, of course, I mispronounced on purpose. And yes, I confess, I did go back to his dressing room that he swelled with Cuban cigar smoke, a suggestion of cologne, and jokes about his double-knotted wife. Peter really did teach me the purpose of curtains, the art of deceit, how to bone a soliloquy till it fit on a cuff, how to scratch a quote into my watch strap with a compass, how to write a key line in white ink. Peter and I, we had, let's say, an arrangement. He would bring the sniff and fizz to this back street hotel. Not exactly what Daddy meant by cultural, but I say a bit of rough, his character building stuff. We would meet in room 101 at the same time every week with this really cheap seedy hotel. I remember the ensuite, it was a scream of lemon and lime tiles. Toilet was a terrified white. He would cling to nicotine, blow smoke rings like ochre halos in my hair. As the mirror stared at our unstitched sex, as we faked ourselves in that 100 square feet of wood chip and veneer, where creases gossiped in off-white cotton, and our shadows fucked like rabid dogs against the wall. Of course, in time, water finds its own level, and it became time to dismiss Miss Susie soon. But I still get in touch when I need to, you know, scratch the itch. She's got a job now as night receptionist at the Bella Vista Bed and Breakfast. It's easy money, and she says the manager doesn't mention all the butts and doodles she leaves behind like clues, doesn't mind the everythings she doesn't do. She says he knows she buys fags from the petty cash, turns a blind eye to the curious optics of all the mistakes that whiskey makes. And meanwhile, I just sniffed out the expats, kept my eye open for the Mercedes, the Beamers, Jags, wore my set. I met this young couple, very laissez-faire, Jackson and Amanda. Yes, we became very good friends. They lured me into their soft storm, drew me like a poultice, and I never will forget the taste of those scarlet slingbacks, or that black satin hip-hub skirt that clung like pennants between her legs. Oh yes, we became very good friends. Jackson, he liked to beg. He liked this particular game. I would let him lie his head on my inner thigh, just close enough to smell me, while Amanda wound his stray nape pairs tight anti-clockwise, and we'd listen to him beg like a pale child, mauling damage. Of course, everything has a sell-by date. I mean, how much fucking paella can a girl eat? So the time came, and it was simply a case of home, James. Anyway, Daddy wanted me to meet his new best friend, a man called Sebastian, the new black in real estate. Daddy knows his daughter best, so I was home and engaged with a fuck-off rock by Christmas. Daddy, he's so clever. Sebastian, we are a match made in heaven. We don't bother each other with stupid questions. We know we're not swans. Jealousy is for children. Like this morning, I heard his heel click as the door shut. I heard him the 11 steps it takes to the elevator. Then the pause as he walked across the car park. Then his ignition kicked in. Took him scurrying back to that other bed where she would be waiting. I stretch my leg into the wet patch he left and invent all the women who whined around him, the ones who live in sage places, Sloane Square, Hampstead Heath, who flirt with perfect manicures and seem to have this penchant for autumnal silk. The one whose confused perfume he brings back in his hair for me to play with. And the one whose name he pretends to forget. Because darling Sebastian knows I love secrets. He'll be round this evening, back at 10. So I'll spend the morning finding things to avoid. In the afternoon, I might hide behind a seaweed face pack, paint my nails, shave his territory. Then I'll choose moody music to moan round the room like a porcelain porcelain whore. And then as a special treat, I might dress Mandy, the mannequin, in his favourite bra. The one he wasted a fortune on that abandoned afternoon in Camden. And just before the door clicks, I'll make sure he finds me where I was left. Yes, me and Sebastian, we are a match made in heaven. But as I said, Daddy knows his daughter best. That's her.
Thank you for having me to
the story. Right, the last one. do like her. None of these are autobiographical, by the way.
Sure, yeah.
They're not, but I'm working on it.
Way.
Now, this third one, how much time have I got? I don't know what I
was going to hit. You have time.
Yeah. Right, this is the last one. And this is a lady called Joan. Joan is about 36. Her husband David is about 38. She's got two kids. One lad who's called Dan, and one girl who's called Chloe. Her husband David, he dies prematurely of a stroke. As I say, Chloe's about 6, Dan's 8, David's 38. He has, I don't know how much you know about these things, but he has what they call TIAs, which are warnings, come sometimes before someone has a massive stroke. He has two of them, and on the third one, he doesn't, you know, do very well. So, and for some reason, Joan comes from the north of England, so bear with the accent. Don't talk to me about God. God is just a sick, fucking, twisted bastard. Don't tell me everything's for reason. What don't kill you makes you stronger, just fuck off. Fuck off, lot of you. See, the way I look at it is this. If God existed, then why would he give me a man like David in the first place? Let me taste his skin, plant his children in me, then just take him away. I mean, 3 slow bullets were all it took. His head went up in smoke. The doctor called it something fancy, but to the likes of you and I, it was a stroke. The first slow bullet came, I were up my mum's, hanging curtains and phone rang. It was Daffy, my neighbour, he said, John, love, Dan, has found David on the kitchen floor. He said, they've taken him in. Best to go up there quick. He said, not to worry, love, I'll look after the kids. They kept him in for test. A week later, we went to London to get the results. I knew it was bad news as soon as I walked in the room. A woman's intuition. That's a cursed blessing. I can honestly say, for the first time in my life, I sat on wrong side of sympathy. As Dr. Mason's manicured words outlined the shadow that had crawled around his skull like spiteful ivy since last autumn. I remember there was a painting in her consulting room. David hated it. He said it was pretentious. It was called Mountain, oil on canvas, signed by a contrived hand and underlined. I know it sounds daft, but for a moment, the truth really did make the view look bigger. Outside, London were just still happening. Red, amber, green. Brixton was just planning its tea. I watched David, he was fussing with his cuff like a truant. As the diagnosis was disguised in plain English for us to take home to kids like bloody gift-wrapped grenade. Forever gracious, my David offered to drive. He knew him, oh, petrified at twilight. We sat gridlocked, then as if it just didn't matter. He leant forward, lit a violin, now took radio, and I contemplated everything I couldn't know. We pulled into drive, parked. Chloe's bike was still against the shed where yesterday I'd left it. I thought, now, Joan, now, love, now is where the end begins. So I started to collect all his silhouettes, every fingerprint he left on glass and plastic, discarded shadows and his leftover profiles, and all the little sketches I never showed him. for portrait I painted when the time came. Called it David, oil on canvas, abstract, and hung it at that pretentious angle only you would understand. Then the second slow bullet, bang. Flying off up my mum's again, I brought her up skirt she'd ordered from catalogue at 4-9. Daphne again. He said, John love, Chloe. She heard David fall downstairs. Bless her. She called the ambulance all by herself. Daphne said, go on, Joe, best get there quick. Not to worry, I'll look after him. When I got there, I wish I'd never taught Chloe how to use the phone. I wish she'd just left him for dead. Because now he was just stuck in this nowhere place. Plugged in, strapped down. I didn't hold his hand, didn't tell him I loved him like they do in films. If I'm honest, there were a part of me that fucking hated it. Don't know how long I was there, watching his pulse limp across the screen like a broken bird. The monitor hiccuped, coughed. I watched him smothering toxic sleep and imagined his brain just leaking provocatively. They kept him like that for weeks. I begged them to give him some drug, you know, put him out of his misery. But it's illegal in this fucking country. They kept him like that for a month, just tick-tocking on till time came. And they sent him to a long-term stroke ward. And don't you dare talk to me about God. Don't talk to me about God till you've been to one of those places. God, it was a mess. A gallery of spilt profiles, half-baked faces, warped jawbones, smiles bent like plasticine in warm hands. And my David's arms, they sort of hung at impossible angles off starched pillars. His legs slung, clumsy as jackstraws under the same tables as every day. My David. He was like a cutlery drawer, upturned into a wheelchair, and I fed him grapes with speechless hands. In that circus of wounded animals, all just teetering on the edge, like barflies on two high stools. I visited him every day after work. We'd make chit-chat with the familiar wards staff, then sit in the polite day room and wait for the pastel uniform to wear him in. He'd sit opposite, drool and grunt like selfish sex and the fucking charade would begin. I'd mind my day unconvincingly while David, well, he just stared into somewhere else. Didn't talk much since the stroke bit his tongue out. Burst his head like a black and red feathered pillar, leaving him to struggle, poor bustling like a choking fish. And it broke my heart to listen to this once articulate man, his boiled voice just gargling wrong answers to crossword clues. I used to feed him mashed banana with a plastic spoon, pick out soft centres, peel fruit with patient blade, tidy his bedside cabinet every evening before I'd leave. I'd make up gossip and well wishes from neighbours that never visited and repeat the same other animated tales about two kids he couldn't remember since his head collapsed. So don't fucking talk to me about God till you've seen a young lad like Joshua Rock. You were 22. Looked like Robert De Niro. He'd just sit in a window seat next to an irrelevant view. He was oblivious to this circus that two nurses strapped him into three times a day. To suck the beige poor ale, laced with pills he couldn't swallow or had no veins left for, that his too thin girlfriend fed him between breaths. God, I prayed he couldn't taste them. God, I prayed he couldn't remember the name of her favourite perfume. Or that moment when he used to close his eyes and hide inside her. Now Joshua rocks, because that's what Joshua does. Teeters on the edge, like a barfly on a too high stool. Then the third blow, slow bullet bang. I was at checkout in Asda's and phone rang. It was Dr. Mason. He said, sorry, but David's taken a turn for worst. I suggest you get here fast. So I turned the phone off, left trolley where it stood, and walked slow as I could to wrong bus stop on Grey Lane. Didn't want the one that went straight to hospital. I wanted the one that went past our house. I wanted just a little bit of time, you know, left for us. As we passed, I noticed Chloe's back. It was still against the shed. The door could do with a lick of paint. And the grass hasn't been cut for months. But them's my David's jobs. That was 4 years ago today. And God knows I'm doing the best to pick up the pieces. But things must be really simple now. Because I am incapable of edges. Yes, I know somewhere a child is being bent. Yes, I know somewhere a car crash is drawing its last breath. But things must be bloody simple now. Because I am incapable of edges. So don't talk to me about God. God is just a sick, fucking, twisted bastard. That's her.